in the context of today's presentation, it's probably a very corny remark to kick off with, but I've been waiting for my food all day, and here at last, it's arrived. And this evening we have an expert who has worked in a whole variety of fields, which is so new to me that I'm going to have to resort to my prompt notes, which lets me think a little bit about what summer school is truly about, and that is about you folk coming to discover new stuff that perhaps, like me, you never picked up on at university. And when I was at university all those decades ago, certainly we weren't taught anything about food or food chains or food supply. We took it for granted. And some of the vocabulary which I've been learning recently is, you know, completely from left field for me. I expect it perhaps will be for some of you too. And Jane has worked, beavered away for, gosh, 5 years or more, 4 or 5 years, on these issues of food security, urban land claims, land and race, food and climate change. And she's going to be presenting some of her findings and thoughts along those lines to us this evening. Urban ecosystems is one of the terminologies that I had to write down on my prompt sheet. Something that's new and absolutely fascinating about cities. Jane comes to us and has been with us since 1998, leading the Urban Food Security Program at UCT. She comes to us from Oxford University, where she got her PhD. And she had a background before that, studying at King's College in London, which means she's one of the very few people, I think, who both have a King's link and a Queen's link, because she's also been working in association with Queen's University on the other side of the pond in Kingston, Canada, which has in a sense been headquartering and anchoring the African Food Security Network program. They've been part of the intellectual partnership that Jane has been very active working with. She's been elaborating some of her interests and is starting this year in a completely different sort of direction with the ACC, the African Centre for Cities. And this draws out some of her earlier training and interest in more philosophical sorts of matters. And she's starting work this month with what we call our Ways of Knowing project, which takes me into an orbit which I can't even begin to explain to you, it's so new to me. And I'll perhaps need her to reflect on some of those things. So please welcome Jane, who will be talking to us today about food services and food security in Africa and in the cities in Africa. All of you.
Well, thank you everyone for coming out tonight. I know this is the third in the series on African cities, and I think you'll hear a very different perspective on the city tonight than what you heard last night. Last night was very much about the central city and densification. Today we're much more looking at the periphery of the city and some of the challenges that happen there. And as Gordon said, he'd never really given much thought to food in... where does this one go? Okay, I'll try and speak louder. Is that... Hold on, John. Okay. Is that better? Okay, testing.
Does that sound okay? To speak a bit, Jane.
Okay, we'll see if this does this work now.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, that was always going to happen. We've had all number of technical hitches already tonight, so this was going to be the last one. Anyway, as Gordon said, he hadn't really thought much about food in the city, and the reality is that nobody has. Food is one of those necessities in life. You think about the things you need in life. You need air, water, shelter, and food. And you think about the things that cities plan for, you think about the things that come up in the press about the challenges of our cities. It's housing, it's water, sanitation, air quality, all those kinds of things. But nobody ever talks about food. We just expect food to somehow be there. And if you look in urban planning, you look in urban studies, there's been this massive absence of food. We think, well, as long as it's cheap and it'll keep and it's there, everything's okay. And the reality is, as you'll see in this presentation, that food isn't always there, it isn't always cheap, it isn't always available, it certainly isn't accessible for the poor of our city. Not only that, there's a large body of work around food security at the global scale, at the regional scale, and yet it all focuses on rural areas. And I think this alludes to something Edgar Mayer has spoken about on Monday, that there's still this notion that poverty is a rural problem, that the challenges of development are rural challenges. And yet, as Edgar showed, the face of poverty is increasingly in urban areas. So there's a need to shift away from this idea of food security as being a rural problem to thinking about what it might mean in an urban context. And that's what I'm going to do tonight. Tonight, I'm basically going to talk about how do low-income people in our cities access food? What are some of the challenges? What are some of the opportunities? What are some of the outcomes of that? And then how does our urban food system work? Now, as I said, we don't tend to think about how food gets to us in cities anymore. And this is kind of strange because historically our cities were shaped by food. Our cities could only grow as large as the food supply that could come into them. Your city could only grow as large as you could feed. But as you start to get into the 19th century, that thing starts to change. You start to see mass transit. You start to see opportunities to bring food in from further and further away. And so cities can grow beyond their local food supply. And so around the Industrial Revolution, you see this burgeoning of cities powered by food being brought in from further and further away. And as you get that system changing, people start to think less about how food gets to the city, because it's inevitable, the food just comes in. And so from cities that were planned and designed on the basis of getting food into cities, it's suddenly become a non-issue. But even towards the end of the 19th century, this started to be recognized as a problem. You won't be able to read this, but trust me, I'll read it out. This is a letter written by a New York City planner to Ebenezer Howard, who was working on the Garden City project. And this planner said, let me see if I can read it. There's a strong argument for the establishment of garden cities to be found in the serious situation in which many large cities in America now face, of actual starvation and stoppage of all the city's functions through industrial disturbance. A striking case in point is my own city of New York. Only this winter the city was on the verge of starvation, not because there wasn't sufficient food supplies, but because owing to a strike of transport workers and railway employees, it was impossible to move perishable foodstuffs, which in the course of aid supply of the city were on their way into the city. The effect of this has been not only to bring the city perilously close to starvation, but also greatly to enhance the cost of food at various periods to the consuming public. And so this freedom from thinking about where the supply of food comes from, in some ways is very liberating. It means that our cities can expand, it means that we can get a greater diversity of food, it means we can eat non-seasonal foodstuffs. However, it comes with these risks, because as soon as your food system gets more complex, as soon as it starts to depend on bringing things from a long way away, depending on refrigeration, depending on trade and tariff agreements, you start to increase the vulnerability of that food system. You start to see these kinds of shocks and stresses coming in. And that problem that was identified at the turn of the 20th century has only become greater in the last century. So this is a map I took from the Guardian newspaper a few months ago, showing the potential challenge of land grabs, of countries buying up land in other countries, or companies from countries buying up land in other countries in order to supply their own food needs. And so you'll see there's massive buying up of land by China and South Korea in places like Madagascar, Sudan, the Philippines. The Saudi government are owning an awful lot of land in Indonesia, all to try and guarantee food supply in their cities. As Edgar said, these are the regions of the world that are facing the largest sort of urbanization, and those populations have to be fed. And so you're seeing this kind of massive change in how food gets to cities and the distances from which the food we eat comes. And we don't really understand the complexity of this. Take a simple thing like if you buy a box of liquid fruit juice, and it says on the back, contains apple and or pear and or grape and or, you think, well, why can't they make their minds up? And the reality is that it's all around the gluts in fruit prices. And so if the cheapest fruit juice they can access at the time comes from oranges from Argentina, and they can denature that flavor, they'll put that in there rather than using local grape juice that may be more expensive at the time. So you've kind of got this this complex food system that we're not really understanding. And this complex food system is increasingly vulnerable to price shocks. So this is some data produced by the FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, just showing food price commodity index. And you can see how food prices are becoming increasingly erratic. We had a massive food price hike in 2008. We had another one last year. And part of this is this increasingly globalized food system that responds to these different kinds of shocks and stresses. It may be crop failures, it may be commodity markets, it may be speculation by traders, maybe just trying to figure out how the biofuels industry fits into the food supply industry. All these things are making the system very volatile. And this matters because of things like this. This graph shows the FAO food price index, and each of these red lines indicates the beginning date of a food riot. And there seems to be something around food prices and some of the challenges that we see in our cities. They argue that one of the triggers for the Arab Spring last year was initially a protest about food prices in Tunisia. So there's this question about what happens to food in our cities and how do populations respond? We know that when food becomes more expensive, it sets in place a whole lot of developmental challenges. And the cities where people are dependent on the cash economy to buy food are profoundly vulnerable to these changes in price. But this is kind of the big picture. This is all sort of nebulous and maybe quite hard to grapple with. So I'm going to bring it down to a single woman living in Kanini in Stellenbosch. This is a project done by a student at the Sustainability Institute. I'm just going to show you a 10-minute video clip of Eunice talking about food. So try and hold this sort of big picture in your head as you hear this woman talking about how she gets food on a daily basis. Sorry, I overshot. Could we get a technical person? So this worked perfectly about 10 minutes ago. Yeah, I think we'll have to do that. Okay, at least this one's working again. Okay, unfortunately that hasn't worked, which gives me more time to talk, so you'll have to bear with me on that. Anyway, this was Eunice, who lives in Ekanini, just talking about her daily diet, what she eats, where she gets her food from, and I'll allude to some of the issues as we go through. Seen the video, but we don't. Now, we can do a number of case studies. We can talk about individuals and how they navigate the system, and that's what the video would have shown. But there's only so much the individual stories can tell us about how the system works. And so as the AFSUN group, the African Food Security Urban Network, we've been trying to look at this challenge of food security. How do the urban poor access food, and how is it tied into these bigger questions? And so AFSUN is a partnership of 11 cities working in nine countries in the region. And what we've got is we've got a research, a policy, and capacity development mandate. What we're required to do is to do research to try and understand this challenge. As I said at the start, nobody's really bothered with the urban food question before. Are we still... Okay, can... Okay, are we back? Is this okay? I'll not touch anything. I'll just pop myself. Okay, so nobody's really looked at the challenge. We implicitly know there's a problem with food security. We kind of have that feeling, but there wasn't really any data to go on. And we're trying to influence policy to help governments to think through how to address the food security challenge. But in order to do that, we needed to get the data to support what we're doing. So we've done this research. We've rolled out the project in 2008, 2009. And subsequent to that, we've been working with each of our cities to try and help them think through what the impacts of our research might be, and then try to do some training. So the three questions we've been working with are, how do the poor in our cities access food? And as you'll see, the reality is that often they don't. But then going from that to the bigger question of thinking, well, how is that shaped by the city? So we know there's poor people living in our cities. We know they're not accessing food. But is it not more of a function of how the city's designed and how the city's managed? Edgar and Ismail yesterday spoke about the peripheralization of the poor being forced to live on the periphery of the city, away from employment opportunities, and it seems away from food markets. So how are there design challenges in the city that need to be addressed? And what are the governance impacts of that? So when we talk about food security, and it's probably a new concept to many of you, what we're talking about is looking at the ability to secure an adequate daily supply of food that's affordable, nutritious, hygienic, and culturally appropriate. So we're not talking about just making sure that people have got rice in their bellies, and if that's done, that's okay. It's looking at affordable, nutritious, hygienic, and culturally appropriate, but then also looking at it in the context of a food system. So it's not just enough to sort of throw in food aid and hope we're addressing the problem. It's thinking about how that whole food system holds together. And what we realise is there's a need for an urban focus. There's a need to understand how the city plays into this challenge. It's not a study of hunger. It's not a study of nutrition. It's just trying to understand how the system holds together. Okay. And so in Cape Town, we worked in three sites. We wanted to try and understand how this thing held together. And we realised that cities are different. Cape Town is different to Joburg, but also places in Cape Town are different to each other. And so we worked in three areas of the city. We started out in Ocean View, partly because we wanted to capture the impact of the fishing community. So were people able to survive better because they were able to fish? We worked in Brown's Farm in Philippi, because it's located next to the Philippi Horticultural Area. There's a large urban agriculture project working there, so we thought maybe we'd find people growing food and surviving that way. And then we worked in Panini and Kuyasa in Khayelitsha on the edge of the city. If you drive out Baden-Powell Drive, it's the last bit of Cape Town you hit. And the idea with sampling there was we thought, well, these are predominantly recent migrants from the Eastern Cape, so maybe they're getting remittances, maybe they're getting food sent through from the Eastern Cape to survive. That was the expectation. We found more people in Philippi getting remittances than in Khayelitsha, more people fishing in Khayelitsha than Ocean View, more people farming in Ocean View than Philippi. So the thing with research is your assumptions never work. So we worked in these three different areas, trying to capture how people were accessing food, what they were eating, and what the challenges were. And across the 11 cities, we found very, very high food insecurity. Across these 11 cities, on average, 77% of sampled households were struggling with food insecurity. And here's the thing, we think of Cape Town as being a wealthy city compared to Manzini, Maputo, etc. And yet in Cape Town, 80% of our sample were struggling with food insecurity. And yet Cape Town is a prosperous city. We don't have food shortages, we don't have those challenges, and yet that's the reality. So let's just back up a little bit and look at what we're talking about when we're talking about food insecurity, just so you have a sense. What we used was a measure developed by FANTA, which is a part of USAID. And they have this matrix where you ask 9 simple questions, ranging from, in the past 4 weeks, did you worry that your household wouldn't have enough food, all the way down to, did you or any household member go a whole day and night without eating anything because there wasn't not enough food? So we're capturing some of the kind of subjective nature of food insecurity, the fears that you're not going to have enough. These more objective things, where you're reducing the number of meals, reducing meal size, absolutely going without. And there's a clever little matrix that you do to figure out who's food secure and who's not food secure. But In our survey, we said anyone who fell into the categories moderately food secure, moderately food insecure, or severely food insecure could be counted as food insecure in our survey. And moderate food insecurity is when you're reducing the dietary diversity, you're eating monotonous diet, you're eating foods you don't necessarily want to eat, but you have to because they're all you can afford, and you're reducing meal sizes. In a severely food insecure house, you're cutting down the number of meals, the size of meals, and often even going without. Okay, so that's the categorization we're using. So it's not absolute hunger, but it's certainly reduction of diet, reduction of quantity, quality, and even absolute reduction in food. And so in Cape Town, we found 80% of households could fall into one or two of those categories, which is quite sobering. And the question is, well, you know, there's been all this focus in rural areas. Is Cape Town worse than a rural area? And cunningly, we found a survey that used, a study that used the same survey tool as us, working in Klipplaat in the Eastern Cape, a rural site. And in Klipplaat, 100% of the sampled households fell into food insecurity. So you can argue that food insecurity is worse in rural areas. But if you look at our sites, Ward 95 is the Khayelitsha site, Ward 34 is the Philippi site, we actually found a higher proportion of our households falling into severe food insecurity than in the rural area. And what seems to be the case is that when something goes wrong with your ability to access food in an urban area, the consequences are far worse than in a rural area. In a rural area, it's often possible to draw on more extensive social networks. It's possible to have a plot that you grow your vegetables on, that kind of thing. In an urban area, a lot of those social networks have fallen away, and a lot of the capacity to get food in a non-monetary way have fallen away. So it seems there's a real challenge. We also found there was a very strong seasonality to food insecurity. And this is surprising. In a rural area, you expect to see this because there's harvests and kind of seasons of glut and seasons of famine. In an urban area, the food supply is constant throughout the year. So why do we see these kinds of peaks and troughs? Why are people going hungry in January and in winter and not at other times of year? And had we heard Mama Eunice speaking, we would have captured some of that. In the interview, they said to Eunice, if you had another couple of hundred rand, what other food would you buy? And her answer wasn't about buying more food, it was about buying clothes for her children, about buying fuel and those kinds of things. What we're seeing is that people will sometimes choose to go hungry in order to meet their other needs. And so when you have periods of high expenditure, so in winter when you need to buy more fuel, more clothing, in January when you're paying off debts, or you have times of reduced income, and you think about casual labor, and the kind of shutdown of casual labor in December, January, while everyone goes on holiday, you suddenly see why you start to see peaks in January and peaks in the winter. There's a tighter set of periodicity as well. We found that a lot of households would do well for the first few weeks of the month and then go hungry the last few weeks. And so that the kind of grant runs out, the money runs out, the month carries on, that kind of challenge. What we see is that people, as the month goes on, they eat worse and worse and less, which in the context of health and development is profoundly dangerous for a household. You think about households on ARVs, antiretrovirals, of which there are many in our sample. In order for the ARVs to be efficient, you need to have consistent nutrition. The nutrition required by somebody living with HIV and AIDS is far higher than somebody who's not impacted. And so if you have this kind of monthly cycle of eating well and then eating badly, eating well and eating badly, the health consequences of that are quite serious. So we've kind of got this ongoing challenge. We've also got people eating a very limited diet. So this is a quick snapshot. We said, of these 12 categories of food, what did anybody in your household eat in the last 24 hours? And out of 12, we found the average household was eating 6 out of 12, which doesn't sound too bad. But then you look at this graph and look at what the most commonly consumed foodstuffs were. So the most commonly consumed foodstuffs was the cereals, so it's the bread, it's the rice, it's the maize. That's kind of good food. But the next most commonly consumed foods are all at this tail end. Other foods, foods made with sugar, foods made with fat. Other foods, by the way, was inevitably tea and coffee. And so if you've got a household that's eating 6 types of food in a day, and 3 of those are tea or coffee and sugar and foods made with fat, it's not a very nutritious diet. It's a diet that can fill you up. It's a diet that can give you energy to go and do your daily work, daily survival. But it's very low in micronutrients. It's got a whole bunch of long-term development challenges there. We then thought it was interesting to look at where people get their food from. And this graph throws up a lot of questions about how people survive in the city. The first thing that strikes me when I look at this is when we talk about food insecurity, the first solution everyone jumps to, be it the city government, be it NGOs, be it general population, always want to talk about people growing vegetables as the solution, as if it's kind of the obvious answer. But in our survey, we found less than 5% of our sample were actually growing any food. So what seems to be the obvious solution to us isn't the obvious solution to the person struggling with food insecurity. And we can talk a lot about why that might be. What we do see is that on a monthly basis, most households will access a supermarket. But on a day-to-day basis, there's much higher dependency in this sector. The small shop, the spaza, the informal market. And this is an interesting dynamic because oftentimes the food that's in the informal sector is more expensive per unit. Often it's less good quality, highly processed. And supermarkets are cheaper and have better food. So why are people daily buying more expensive bad food than the good food they get at a supermarket? And there's a number of reasons for this that we think we're coming to. First off, the supermarkets are a recent addition to township geographies. They're moving in at pace. There's a new shop, right? There's a new spa going in virtually every month into a township in Cape Town. But they're not traditionally a part of the food system. A lot of the supermarket purchases we're seeing are still actually being bought in areas like Weinberg next to the taxi rank. There's a new pick and pay that's just gone in on Main Road. That largely services the population who are transiting home to work. We know also the ShopRite in Mowbray has a similar kind of characteristic. So people are buying where it's convenient. Supermarkets, although they're cheaper per unit, tend to sell in large bulk, which if you don't have access to transport, is not easy to buy. They sell in large bulk, so it's cheaper per unit, but the bulk is too expensive for people to buy. So people will buy smaller and more expensive because that's what they can afford. And so you find this dynamic going on. The other thing we found really quite interesting was this whole area here. People will talk about how there's no social capital in cities, and yet we saw a large number of households sharing food with neighbours, borrowing food from neighbours, getting food from these informal networks, which partly speaks to the fact that the market isn't working, because if people are resorting to this, then the market's clearly not working for the urban poor. But it also speaks to some of the good things that are happening in our areas. So we've kind of got this dynamic of how people are getting food and how people aren't. And just want to remind you, 80% in our sample areas were struggling with food insecurity. And so how do we think about finding a solution? And what we're thinking with our unit is we need to think beyond this obvious solution. The obvious solution is get people to grow their own food. It's not taking off. There's pockets where it's working well, but generally it's not working. So we need to think beyond simply getting food gardens. We also need to think beyond simply a handout of food vouchers. We spent a few days working with one city that will remain nameless in South Africa. And we turned up and we're trying to help them think through how to solve this challenge. And they started with food gardens, and after 2 days we got them to expand their vision from food gardens to food gardens plus vouchers, and they could go no further. And we're trying to get people and cities to think about how do the complexities of this food system operate? How can we plan for a better food system? How do we plan so that people can access the foods they need throughout the month, throughout the year? And what we think is we need to be able to write the city in. We need not just think about people living in cities, but how the city shapes how people get food. And the challenge has been that it hasn't really been done in South Africa or in Africa generally. So we've had to look at a model that's been imported from the US and from Europe. And so we've used this idea of the food desert as an entry point. And the food desert is an idea that's had a lot of traction in North America and Europe. And a food desert is basically this. Those areas of inner cities where cheap, nutritious food is virtually unobtainable,
and carless residents unable to reach out-of-town supermarkets depend on the corner shop where prices are high, products are processed, and fresh fruit and veg are poor or non-existent.
Which sounds familiar to what I've been describing. And this is the kind of context that's been quite popular in the US. They're using this as a kind of food justice project to mobilize around changing the food system. And it's very dependent on sort of mapping. So this is a food desert project from Chicago. And this map highlights areas that are poorly located in terms of access to supermarkets. And then on the next map, they've highlighted where there's populations of ethnic minorities in the cities. And you can see there's this close tracking. And it seems to replicate some of the things we're seeing, but you think about how many supermarkets there are in the Claremont Constantius compared to what's going on in the Philippines, the Kailiches. And so there seems to be something within that we can start to use to make an argument for how our cities can operate better in terms of food. However, our food system down here is very, very different to what happens in North America, to what happens in Europe. And implicit in that, although it's not really there, is the idea that if we put a supermarket on every corner, we're going to solve the problem. And I don't think that's the answer. Because despite the fact we've got the spazas, which are charging expensive and selling rubbish, we've also got this thriving fresh fruit and veg market that operates. And this fresh fruit and vegetable that you'll see on the sides of the road is generally cheaper than the supermarkets. It's generally fresher than the supermarkets. We know that fruit and vegetables, well, particularly vegetables that are grown in the Philippi horticultural area, are harvested, go to the Cape Town Fresh Produce Market one day, sold to the informal traders the next day, and sold to the purchasers. So 2 days out of the soil. Whereas the same vegetables from the Philippi horticultural area get sold to a shop right if you can pay, go into cold storage, may go all the way up to Joburg and come back down, maybe several weeks old by the time it gets to you, and it's more expensive. And so arguing that putting in the supermarkets is the best answer is not necessarily true. We do have some opportunities that should be recognized. That's not saying that the informal food sector is perfect, because we also have delights such as this. So we need to be a little careful when we're exalting the values of the informal sector and hold a little bit of reality. But we need to recognize that there's connections between what happens in the formal and the informal sector. So a lot of the traders are buying from Macro, buying from a ShopRite, and selling on. So there's these connections that we don't really understand. And also the whole food deserts notion doesn't really capture the dynamics of how people navigate their food environment. And so if you go to Kailiche, next to the taxi ranks, there's all these, what do you call them, braai stands. Apparently, I've heard from Gareth, number 16 is the one to go to. If you're going to go and buy a meat in Kailiche, number 16 taxi rank is the way to go. But trying to capture these dynamics of how people live their food system, what choices they make, why they go, where they go, when they go. And so it's that process of, you know, how does it tie in with where you live, where you work? This is the Jobo Bree Street taxi rank. Again, they set up a large informal trading sector there, knowing that people who work in the city, who live in the townships, will be buying their food on the way home from home, way home from work. And so this idea of mapping food deserts is one thing, but it doesn't capture how people live, move, and have their being in the city. And we need to capture some of that. And it really doesn't capture the dynamics. And although the picture of 80% food insecurity is horribly depressing, I think there's something quite fascinating about how this food system works. So if you'll give me a few minutes, I'm going to read a section that's going to be coming out soon in a book by Leonie Joubert. And Leonie's been working on, it's kind of a popular science book, so if you're not going to read the academic text, Leonie's doing this great book about how people get food in cities. And she's been working with a photographer, and I'm going to show you some of the shots there. But let's just take a few minutes to listen to this. So this is Leonie's visit to Prince Albert in the Karoo. Okay. So she says, they call it All Pay Day, the day when social grants get doled out at the local post office. Pensions for the over 60s, the unemployment grant, the child grant. And on All Pay Day, the dusty little Karoo town of Prince Albert erupts with life.
The pavements, which usually slumber through the rest of the day, become a trail of loud, vibrant, colourful markets. Everything from plastic toys, glue sticks, clothes pegs, batteries, t-shirts, scarves, socks, beanies, underwear, food all laid out, spread out on trestle tables or on the cloth on the ground. There are braais sizzling with half chickens, with vorse, with ribs. Enormous enamel tubs of potato salad, mealies darkened on the coals, patkos for passing pedestrians. The mood is festive, almost celebratory. The bottle stores also report a roaring trade on that day. But it's the smosa, who arrive from Cape Town, some 4 hours' drive away, that make this market so unusual, compared with all the other informal traders you'll meet in Cape Town. Abdul and Farid from Delft say they drive up to Prince Albert and many other towns in the Karoo every month end, following the payday payouts. They load up their bucky with pantry basics bought on wholesale in the city and package them into different hampers priced at 400 rand, 300 rand, 250 rand, depending on the contents. Now, these hampers are a big business in Prince Albert. Most of the local retailers package up the basic groceries into hampers, which they pitch at different prices. Just about everything you need for a month in one easy purchase. White bread, flour, mealie meal, samp, beans, potatoes, sugar, packets of yeast, olive oil, cordial, cans of beans, toilet paper, a bar of sunlight soap, washing powder. The only fresh food in these hampers were things that had long legs, had longevity, like potatoes or citrus fruit. Now, the benefit for people with such meager resources is that they get all the basics they'll need for the month without having to trawl the shelves or decide how much to divvy up for the monthly budget. It's also a matter of storage. For the cash-strapped families, this kind of food is a safe investment. You use it before you have to make electricity payments, before you have to make school fee payments, all those kinds of things. Now, what makes Abdul and Farid competitive coming from Cape Town in a market where the local shops have their own well-priced hampers is the fact that they do home deliveries. For no extra fee, they'll drop the hamper off at the customer's house. A month's supply of groceries weighs a fair bit. And for a community where most people have to get about on foot, having a bucket to deliver makes a huge bonus. And people can go straight from getting their grants, getting an entire month of groceries before the debit orders come off, before the school fees or the tuck shop or luxury buys. At least the food is bought. One family of three, there are two pensioners and one employed nursery worker, live in a one-end block in Noorend, and they buy a 300 rand hamper. Marai, the main breadwinner, generally buys a hamper with samp, beans, etc. She'll buy meat too, a half sheep, usually cut into meal-sized portions on account of the local butcher, something for which she pays 600 rand a month. She seldom buys from the small shops in her community in Noorend, Prince Albert, because they're too expensive, she says. In exchange for being spared a long walk into town, you'll pay 8 or 9 rand a loaf in the township. In town, you'll get the loaf for just 5 rand. And 3 rand matters a lot when you're this close to the breadline. So at the end of the day, once the grants have been paid and a large part of the money's been spent, the smosa pack up their mobile stores, the wares are folded away into bale-sized bags, tables collapsed once more, and just like that, they're gone. The markets disappear. The following day, the streets and the pavements have returned to their normal state, sleepy, dusty, and quiet, but for the occasional rush hour bustle. You see, this captures some of the dynamics. With kind of food desert mapping, you don't capture that. With individuals' kind of narrations of their food, you don't get that. But when you see this kind of, it's almost like you can see David Attenborough doing that kind of desert bloom story. This is what we're seeing here. We're seeing this kind of vibrant, dynamic food economy that has elements of the formal food system, has elements of the informal food system, has food coming all the way from Cape Town to supply this market. We need to understand how that thing works, because if we're going to make a resilient food system, a system where people are food secure, we need to understand how all those things come together. Because it's a systems problem. It's not a poverty problem per se. It's not just that people can't afford food. It's a systems problem. This is what Desmond Tutu said in a statement for Oxfam. He said, "Hunger is not a natural phenomenon. It's a man-made tragedy. People don't go hungry because there's not enough food in the world. They go hungry because the system which delivers food from fields to our plates is broken." And now in this new age of crisis, with increasing severe and extreme weather and dwindling natural resources, and I might add fuel price hikes, I might add energy price hikes, all those things, feeding the world will get harder still. And so we need to think about the system, we need to think about solutions. So where do we look?
As I've said a few times, people turn to this obvious answer of the New Hope project, the urban agriculture that's going to save us all. But the reality is that people are not farming. And people don't see it as a viable or desirable lifestyle. So I don't think the solution is going to come there. I also don't think the solution is going to be in bringing every supermarket to a township, this large distribution center model. And we can talk maybe about why I don't think that's the answer.
But for the last three slides, I'm maybe going to put the ball back into your court and try and help you to think through some of these things. So let's think about a few common food items. Cabbage, a chicken, a loaf of bread, mealie meal. And think about, just for a few seconds, how does it get from where it's being grown to the table? What are the processes that get it there?
And oftentimes it's not as simple as you think. So the cabbage that comes out of the ground in Philippi can take multiple paths to get to your table. It can either go straight from the farmer, sold directly via contract to a shop right and go through this long distribution chain, or it can be sold into the informal sector and go through this much shorter food chain to get to you. The chicken, well, where does your chicken come from? If you're
buying the Elgin stuff, you know it's had a happy life, it's not going to come back and haunt you.
But the cheap chickens, the cheap frozen chickens that are sold in supermarkets, often in the townships, well, they come from Brazil. The cheapest chickens you can get come from Brazil. The Chinese takeaway on campus brings their chicken in from Brazil. It's a disturbing thing. And the chickens that are sold live in the townships are born out in the countryside, but fattened in the township and killed there. Very different sets of ways in which things come into the city. And so if we're thinking about building a system that's resilient to a range of shocks, well, where's the vulnerability in each of those systems? What makes the informal trade sector more vulnerable in some ways than the formal? If you think about the projections of fuel price hikes, we all know petrol price goes up all the time and then goes down a little bit and then goes up a lot. What does that do to the food system? If we're looking at a distribution system that sends food from Cape Town to Joburg and back, how vulnerable is that system in terms of food price, in terms of accessibility? We think about the projections for climate change, it matters more and more where our food comes from. We think about things like electricity costs. The electricity prices keep going up. The whole cold storage system on which a lot of our food is dependent becomes more problematic. If climate change happens in Cape Town and the temperatures go up 2 or 3 degrees, the shelf life of foods in the informal sector becomes much, much more reduced, and therefore that system becomes more vulnerable. So we've kind of got to understand how the system works and where all these points of vulnerability are. Because if we're going to make sure that people in the city get the food they need, that's affordable, that's hygienic, that's culturally appropriate, that's nutritious, it's not just enough to hope that it's going to be there. What we need to do is we need to understand how the whole food system operates. Production, the procurement, distribution, sales, storage, consumption, waste management, and how people access food. We need to understand how each point in that system is vulnerable and recognize that actually sometimes having a formal system and an informal system running in tandem can actually be the most resilient system, because if one fails, then we've got something else going on. And we need to think about how to make that system work in cities. And so it's around planning as if food is an issue. And that's that's the challenge that I'm working on. That's the challenge that Gareth in the back is working on. And we're hoping to start to get cities to take it seriously. Thank you.
Very core you're about to do with food, I'm going to spare you. I'm so struck with the immediacy of this material that we're dealing with. We all eat, you know, but it's the complexity of the ordinary, I think, is what Jane has drawn out for us so well this evening. Let's take some questions and comments, and I'll try and do this a bit better than yesterday when I got very confused. I see one hand, the lady in pink, the gentleman in blue, the gentleman in brown, and the lady over there will take four. Are you happy? for that, Jane?
Yep, I'll talk to Tyler.
And then we'll go for another round of what? So, the menu of the picture.
Shall I take that now?
I think there's a number of things. I think land certainly is one of the issues. And definitely if you cannot get land that's adjacent to your property, the challenges of theft and that are a big problem. But we also know that the soils in Cape Town are not great, and it requires a lot of inputs. And there's costs to inputs, so fertilizers, seedlings, all those things have a cost. But we've also found that it's generally the older population who are getting involved in farming. And I've got a student currently working on why the youth are not getting involved. And it is seen as an undesirable thing. It's seen as something that's... We came to the urban area to be urban, not to farm. So there's an element of economics, there's not an element of spatial, and then there's the kind of social, cultural elements that come through. And the reality is garden... I grow my own vegetables. I try to. At the moment, I'm working through a glut of cherry tomatoes, and I don't want to see another cherry tomato. And I think there's an element of... Actually, farming's not as easy as it's made out to be. Maybe in Durban it is, but not in Cape Town.
Gentleman with a blue shirt.
My principle is the same.
Okay. You get a little hand? I'm deeply indebted. Gentleman with a brown jacket?
Yeah, just also further on that point. I hear what you're saying. I've spent a bit of time with various organizations and townships, and it seems that there is often a lack of will for people to start their own food gardens, even when it seems like such a obvious way out of food insecurity. And I get the feeling, listening to you, that you've also written it off as an option. Do you see any possibility or way to change this, behavioral change?
Yeah, I mean, I think I haven't written off entirely. I'm just kind of reacting to the knee-jerk that it is the answer. What they have found, there's organizations like Abilini Bezekiah who are doing great work and are trying to get sort of the food to market. And I think one of the challenges is that it's not seen as something that's economically viable. And if people can see that they can start to market it and start to make an income as well as get food out of it, I think there's an element of that. But there's so many projects that are targeted at getting people to start growing food with very little thinking about any value add or any kind of marketing opportunities that come out of that. So I think that's potentially where there's opportunities arising. We're also seeing that some people who have taken up urban agriculture projects often are not doing it for the food, they're doing it for social benefits. There's the health benefits of working the garden, but there's also the benefits of, there's a woman in Philippines who's taken over a patch of land that was sort of a drug dealing spot. And she's taken it over and kind of turned it into a positive community space. And it's that kind of communal benefits rather than food benefits. So I think if we can recognize why people who are gardening are doing it and build on that, then there's potential to make it work. Yeah, unfortunately there's nothing happening at UCT, but VITS are actually doing that at the moment. And they are finding that of a certain cohort, there are certainly challenges of food insecurity. There's very strong nutrition programs in schools, but they tend to die at secondary school level and certainly never progress onwards. And the capacity to learn is often related to nutrition. So I think people really need to figure it out and improve food on campus.
So you touched already the whole field of urban agriculture. I think in Cape Town there are two organizations, Soil for Life and Abilini, do very well work. I wonder still, let me first say this, in Lusaka, I worked in Lusaka, I know it's a much higher percentage who work for themselves in various there is also a much closer link between rural and urban people and exchange of food by families. And I wonder why, what are the constraints in Cape Town? Is it the soil? Is it the mentality of the people? What is in the background that the grow yourself sector is so small?
It's an interesting one, because in our 11 cities, Cape Town was one of the lowest in terms of urban agriculture, and Lusaka and Blantyre were some of the highest. However, in virtually all of the cities, we found less than we had expected. There are a number of reasons. I think the land issue is a crucial issue. I think perhaps the way in which historically in some South African cities and also in places like Harare, the local governments tried to crack down and prevent it from happening. So there's those elements, there's the kind of historical legacy. But certainly I think it's just this notion of what is an urban activity, what is an urban livelihood. And it's just not seen as a viable urban livelihood, particularly when you can buy food cheaper than you can grow it often.
Yeah. Question in the centre, I'll take you.
Jane, you did mention the supermarkets in bulk, and then you kind of didn't say very much about spaza shops. Has much been done about that? Because I've been observing in some of the smaller shops, not necessarily spaza shops, because I'm not in the townships, but the size of the portions that people are buying is critical, and in these smaller places they do accommodate. So, you know, if we're going to have supermarkets in townships, then they've got to take a whole different tack out of the store.
Absolutely. So,
can I just speak a bit more about what the research is of feelings as far as the shops?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we're finding the spas will bulk break. So they'll take a sort of a 12-pack of toilet rolls and break them down and sell them one by one. And buy the much smaller packets of chips and decant rice into smaller packages and that sort of thing. And you end up paying more for less, but at least you can afford to buy that amount. And we're seeing an awful lot of that. And people will do that because it's the way they can afford to buy that. It's the way they can afford to budget on the limited income. The other thing that spazas are doing, not all of them, but many of them, will offer credit. And so we'll find that people, when they run out of money at the end of the month, will go and borrow from a spaza. And oftentimes, because it's relationships of kin, they're not really charged an awful lot of interest. And so it becomes a kind of backup when everything else fails. Which is why I'm concerned about the supermarkets coming in and wiping out a lot of the spaza shops, because they're undercutting prices, because they're ultimately taking away this kind of fallback position the communities have. There's also the challenge of the Somali traders coming in and undercutting the spazas, and that's an interesting dynamic, but it's very complex.
Just a couple of points I'd like to...
Could you speak up just a bit, please?
I'll try.
Thank you.
The areas you have selected as sites for your research are all characterized by high unemployment, which is multi-generational. Find that there's high dependency on social security grants, which somehow becomes a means of saving people from from death, which is something. The other point I'd like to raise is maybe you might want to think about adding Esterplat when you broaden your study, because you will also find similar dynamics in high rates of poverty and unemployment.
Thank you.
But TB, can I just talk also about the TB? People, patients who default on their medication, they do so because of poverty and hunger. Mm. That situation was addressed by the Department of Health when they introduced in the 80s soup kitchens. And they found that, you know, the rate of default was greatly increased when that happened. Mm.
Yeah. Thank you. I agree with all the points.
Yes, lady over there.
Did you also look at the level of education that we bring? What are the aspects of the increasing of quality food or low quality food? Not just knowledge, but people understand how balanced you know, look at what you consume and what's less basic for the effects. Is there something?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I mean, we captured basically all the education stuff, but we didn't go into those dynamics. But I do have a master's student who is actually a dietitian who works for Province, and she's doing her study looking at perceptions of fresh fruit and vegetables, because there's no point in putting in these dietary recommendations if people have no sense of why or no desire to eat those foods. So we're trying to understand a little bit about how people value different food types. So this was just a baseline to try and capture the idea, and then we're using a lot of studies to follow up on some of the things.
Just a comment about political will and education as well. In your experience, through your study, what is it the political will to really change then how people are being educated? Because obviously every greenie and their dog is going bio and gardening, and we see New York, we see Berlin, we see it all happening. And you know, I even want to start a food garden. But the reality is people like Abanimi say they have excess food, and often the people, the neighbors, they don't want the vegetables because maybe they don't have the advantages, or they don't know, you know, that it's good for them, or they're not buying into it. So what I want to know is, are people doing, like, what is the education? Why is there no backing from, you know, higher
Yeah. It's around the kind of what sort of educational structures are in place to try and encourage people to eat better, to take advantage of some of the opportunities for getting fresh fruit and vegetables. For example, with Abilimi trying to offload excess. I think the Department of Nutrition are trying, and there's certainly school projects that are trying to get kids. So groups like Seed are trying to set up food gardens in schools and trying to get kids to understand food by doing it. But I think it is an uphill battle, and I think you know the element of desirable, the element of getting as many calories as you can for the money you can afford, and fresh fruit and veg are generally far lower calories than a lot of the foods that are available. So there's that element that comes in. But there is the desirability element. So if the video had worked, when they're talking to Eunice and managed to get her to say what food she would buy if she had extra money, once she'd paid the school fees and what's that. The things she really desired were Simba chips and to go to the Hungry Lion and to get a 4 parcel. And so there's this kind of, if you're surviving, sometimes a naughty treat is more appealing than some more vegetables.
Time is marching on. I think we'll take 2 more questions. The lady over there has another lady or something. So if you would frame your question,
Risky? You mentioned that there is an ethnic food supply in the town, which is really quite vital and dynamic, which is fast transit and the rise of the roadside stores. So there is a supply of food. I'm asking, what is but people are not necessarily spending all their money on that. So my question is, and you mentioned this prioritization, something that makes you turn around,
I think I can't answer your second question. I have no background in the rural areas, and I wouldn't want to thumbs up. But I do think around your first question, it's around the access question, but it's around how food access is shaped both by what we call the asset base of a household, so what they have and what kinds of other resources they're able to draw on, but also then on the questions of ability. So, for example, if you don't have refrigeration, it really shapes the kinds of things you can buy and the kinds of amounts of things you can buy. You're more likely to buy processed pre-cooked foods. So those kinds of things start cooking. So we need to understand how the house operates in its economic context and in this kind of monthly cycle. So it's, and obviously how that's shaped by these cultural values and sort of historical experience of households. So I just seem to keep adding layers of complexity. And it really shouldn't be that complicated, but it seems to be.
Let's take the final question before we break. I'm going to call it an end here. And thank you all very much for your participation. Jen, is there anything you want to conclude with one parting thought?
If you want to read any of our research, it's all on www.axon.org.
Please come down and chat to James if you want to press a question that you want to carry on. I've been asked to remind you to hand in your evaluation form. It's very important to help in the summer school plan its program for next year and contact the appropriate people. You can do it online, so if you